This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, welcome to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. In this half hour, I'll be reading articles from magazines like Hobby Farms and Mother Earth News that may help us to live life a little more naturally. And today we're going to focus in on some gardening articles. And we will start with Self-Reliance Magazine, Spring 2024, issue number 32. Spring Violets by Julia Stowe. In the late winter months each year, the gray days are brightened by a tiny purple promise of spring, wild violets. This little flower, peering up at the world from beneath heart-shaped leaves, is full of hope and joy, and a host of healthful benefits. Though the common wild violet is often seen as a weed to be eradicated from lawns and garden beds, this delicate but hardy plant is an excellent wild forage food with many nutritional properties. An herb with a long history of medicinal use, it is a colorful addition to any spring meal. There are many species of the genus Viola that grow wild throughout the United States. In nearly every climate and terrain, a different native variety can be found. Yet among most of them, the common wild violet, Viola sororia, also known as the blue violet or the dooryard violet, grows as well. It is easiest to identify by its delicate five-petaled flower, ranging in color from bluish-white to deep purple. There are also yellow wild violets, but most sources recommend avoiding these. Only the white, blue, or purple violets should be consumed. The leaves are smooth and distinctively heart-shaped, with prominent veins on the underside. Common in damp and shady environments, it's a low-growing herb. And unlike most flowering plants, the violet flower does not produce seeds. Instead, a green, unassuming, seed-producing flower forms beneath the violet leaves in late summer. Because of this, it is often said that the violet blooms out of pure exuberance at the coming of spring. It also allows the herbalist to harvest quantities of the flowers without harming the propagation of the plant. Violets have a long and treasured history in folklore and medicinal tradition. They have been associated with faithfulness and innocence and were thought to dispel sorrows and ease grief. Wild pansies also fall under the Viola genus. The common name for pansies is heartsease, Viola tricolor, which likely derives its name from both the emotional connotation and historic use of violet leaves to support heart health. I like to think that the common name, heart's ease, is a result of the bright little flower's ability to gladden the heart and bring a sparkle of spring to late winter days. Traditionally, violets are used to treat sore throats and dry coughs. It is considered to be an excellent herb for upper respiratory ailments, easing congestion, and remedying lingering coughs. Violet flowers have been shown to support the lymphatic system and are high in antioxidants, including vitamin C. It is an anti-inflammatory herb and is often used topically as a cool poultice to ease swelling from insect bites or stings and to gently cool and soothe sunburns. This makes violets the perfect herb to be blooming as the bright sunshine tempts us to long days outside again after the shorter days of the chilly winter months. Violet flowers can be preserved through drying, infusing in oil or vinegar, and even by sugaring them for decorative additions to cakes and pastries. But they are most easily enjoyed fresh while in season. Add a handful of blossoms to a spring salad for color, health, and a peppery flavor, or combine with rose petals and mint and brew as a nutritious and delicious spring tea. Beyond their health benefits and springtime beauty, however, violets possess another exciting property. Like the popular blue pea flower or purple cabbage, violet flowers are a pH indicator. A strong violet infusion will be a deep indigo color, but when something acidic is added, it turns a bright magenta. For an extra special, healthful, and simply beautiful springtime treat, make the violet lemonade recipe below. And here's that recipe for violet lemonade. 4 cups of wild purple violet flowers, 1 cup of boiling water, 1 cup of fresh lemon juice, about 3/4 of a cup to 1 cup of raw sugar or honey. Spread the wild harvested violets on a tray and leave for a little while to allow any insects that might be hiding in the blossoms to crawl away. Place violet flowers in a large glass jar and cover with 1 cup of boiling water. Cover and let steep for at least 2 hours or overnight. Strain the violet infusion through a sieve and press all the juice out of the flowers. The tea will be a dark indigo. Dissolve sugar or honey in a small amount of warm water in a half-gallon pitcher. Add lemon juice and fill with ice. Just before serving, add the violet tea to the pitcher and stir. The resulting magenta beverage will bring a smile to your face, health to your body, and joy to your heart as you remember the humble violet and its bright promise of spring. Let's switch publications to Hobby Farms. This comes from the March-April 2024 issue. And this column is called Agricultural Advice by Samuel Feldman. Winter's Last Stand. Early warm weather followed by a late frost can easily ruin an orchard harvest. Therefore, you must closely keep an eye on the temperature when the spring trees have started to bud. There are charts that show the critical temperatures for different fruit trees at different stages. Though proper site and cultivar selection is most important to prevent early blooming, sometimes late frosts can happen unexpectedly. Most damage is usually done in dips of only several degrees below the danger point for several hours, usually before sunrise. Raising the temperature several degrees in these critical hours could be enough to save the tender blooms. Using water to protect fruit trees from frost is effective and economical. A good soak of the soil before a cold night will be useful, while overhead sprinklers can effectively protect against frost down to 23 degrees Fahrenheit. To be effective, sprinklers should evenly and consistently spray water on the trees, and the wind shouldn't be stronger than 10 miles an hour. When the water hits the leaves, buds, and branches, it freezes, releasing some of its heat. This creates a consistently developing layer of ice, which can keep the plant's temperature at 32 degrees if water is applied at a sufficient rate. Spraying systems vary from specially designed frost protection sprinklers for larger orchards to existing overhead irrigation and even sprinklers placed on ladders for small-scale growers. Whatever is used, it must deliver water at a rate so that the trees are always covered with liquid ice mixture. The sprinkler should be turned on before the temperature hits freezing and must continuously apply water until temperatures have sufficiently risen in the morning. If the sprinklers are stopped too early, the melting ice can lower the temperature to cause damage. Though the process requires some skill, water spraying is a helpful technique that can effectively protect the orchard from late frost. It can also be combined with other frost protection for increased efficiency. Double-walled beehive. Did your bees survive winter? Successfully overwintering honeybees is one of the most challenging parts of beekeeping. Much care is taken to ensure that colonies are prepared for winter, and still losses occur often. Double-walled beehives could help reduce winter losses of colonies. In the wild, honeybees live in tree cavities with much higher insulation than the commonly used beehive. This allows them to survive winters even in the harsh climates of Russia. Unfortunately, creating a hive with the same wall thickness will make it too heavy. This leads to an idea of using two thinner walls with lightweight insulation material in between. The result could improve overwintering and reduce the need for winter feeding, since bees don't need to consume much honey to generate heat. Double-walled hives are also cooler in summer. Another advantage of the double wall is the reduction of condensation inside the beehive. Condensation can be devastating to honeybees. Condensation forms when the comparably warmer, moister air inside the hive encounters the cold walls and small droplets form. Double walls effectively reduce this effect by keeping the temperature of the inner walls closer to that of the hive. Much the same way, double-pane glass windows have less condensation and keep the room warmer and windowsill dry. Some beekeepers suggest making the outer wall thinner than the inner wall so that moisture will more readily evaporate outside than inside. There are some disadvantages to the double-walled beehive. They are heavy, inconvenient to handle, and don't warm up as fast in warm winter days. Double-walled beehive are also twice as expensive, which is mostly why they're rarely used today. Nevertheless, for many beekeepers, the advantages of improved overwintering, less winter feeding, and cooler temperatures in summer are worth the extra cost and effort. Speaking of bees, we'll stick with the same publication. This article is called When the Queen Abdicates. Without a queen to rule, your hive can't survive. This is by Amy Grissack. One of the worst feelings during a hive check is when the queen is nowhere to be found, nor are there new eggs at the bottom of the uncapped comb. Life in the colony suddenly goes from an efficiently run community to a potentially perilous situation. In nearly 3 decades of keeping bees in Montana, my husband and I have seen a lot of queens die. Some coups were planned, but more often the need for a new queen arose because either something unexpected happened to her or the colony decided they needed a new monarch. Besides the desire to save the hive, our challenge is always how to minimize any downtime during our short summer season. Losing a queen at the wrong time might mean no honey harvest from that hive, or slim odds for the colony's survival heading into the winter. But regardless of when it happens, it's always good to know the best way to handle a queenless situation. Creation of the queen. For eons prior to domestication, honeybees successfully managed queen succession. While we still don't completely understand the decision-making process of a honeybee colony, the hive often knows when a queen is failing. In this case, the workers prepare for succession. Queen cups, the beefier base of queen cells, are one indication, although their presence doesn't necessarily mean the workers intend to raise a new queen, but it's something to watch. On the other hand, if the elongated and somewhat peanut-shaped queen cells are present, something is amiss, and the existing queen is on deck for succession, or a swarm is on the horizon. In an emergency when the queen is dead from a multitude of reasons, including being accidentally squished by the beekeeper, workers can also create a new queen from existing eggs in open brood comb. If there are no queen cells, they make them by enlarging the cell, or cells, to accommodate the worker larva they'll develop into a queen. If they feed the worker, and thereby female larvae, exclusively royal jelly when it's younger than 3 days old, they create a queen. For workers and drones not destined for queendom, on the third day their diet changes to worker jelly that consists of pollen and nectar along with only a component of royal jelly. What's particularly noteworthy is it takes fewer days to rear a queen than either a worker or drone. Queens emerge between 15 to 16 days after the egg is laid, versus 21 days for workers and 24 days for drones. And the queens live from 3 to 7 years, far longer than workers existing for a mere 1 to 6 months, and the drones hanging around for 55 days. Role of the queen. On the surface, the consumption of royal jelly seems to be the primary factor in the queen's reign over her sisters. But in reality, pheromones rule their world. One of the effects of the queen's pheromone is it suppresses over the development in the ovaries of the workers, explains Reed Johnson, associate professor for the Department of Entomology at The Ohio State University in Worcester, Ohio. The pheromone helps her maintain her reproductive monopoly. After her mating flight, she has the sole responsibility to create more bees by laying up to 3,000 eggs per day at the peak of the season. Yet while the queen plays a central role in the hive, it's the collective that makes the decisions for the colony, including when she needs to be replaced, which workers sometimes do. It's up to the beekeeper to gain an understanding on when they're considering supersedure, along with assisting the bees to secure a new queen. How to tell if the hive is queenless? All the inspections throughout the season involve locating the queen, or at least signs that she's alive and active. The beekeeper should be looking for eggs, says Johnson, who agrees that the queen is tricky to spot. Check for various levels of egg production. If there are new eggs at the bottom of the comb cell, they were most likely laid within the past 3 days. When there are larvae, but the cells are still uncapped, it's within 9 days. And consider it a 20-day period with capped brood. If new eggs are missing, or most of the brood is capped, it's probably a queenless hive. Laying workers jeopardize the colony. If you notice 2 eggs per chamber, or eggs sticking to the side of the chamber, this indicates laying worker bees. Johnson says that if a queen is absent and the workers are unable to raise a new queen, often because all the available brood comb is capped and beyond the queen developmental stage, some female workers begin laying. You can't tell the laying workers versus regular workers because they look alike, he notes. But their abdomen isn't as long as the queen's, so the eggs end up along the sides. Johnson says this last-ditch effort of the hive makes sense on an evolutionary perspective because the new drones, which are what the unfertilized laying workers produce, might mate with a queen from a different hive, thereby carrying on the genetics. but it is a veritable death sentence for the colony. To queen or not queen. If the queen is gone, one option is to order an outside mated queen to reduce the time for her to rebound in egg production. This is particularly useful later in the season when the time required for the hive to requeen itself before cold weather is reduced. Although sometimes beekeepers opt for a foreign queen simply to better control the situation. Once the queen or queens arrive, introducing her to the hive is very similar to installing a new package of bees. Individual queens arrive in their respective queen cages, sometimes with a worker bee in attendance during the process. Just as with a queen from a package, replace the cork at the end of the queen's cage with a piece of marshmallow or a mixture of honey and wax, and suspend her in the center of the hive. With any luck, the colony accepts her within 2 to 3 days, and life in the hive thrives. Many times, particularly early in the season, it is wiser and easier to let the workers handle your options, include bringing in a mated foreign queen or merging the hive. At this point, the goal is to have enough bees and resources for the hive to make it through the winter. A healthy colony hinges upon the queen's direction and productivity. When something happens to her, it disrupts to the entire colony. There are a multitude of reasons the queen dies, but thankfully there's no reason to panic. Honeybees know what they're doing and can often remedy this situation without us, although it never hurts to lend them a hand to ensure the best outcome. Freelance writer Amy Grisak is patient about teaching people effective gardening techniques, ways to cook and preserve the harvest, and how to create a more sustainable lifestyle. She and her family raise bees and chickens at their Great Falls, Montana home and are always looking for better ways to grow their own food in their challenging climate. Follow her adventures at amygrisak.com. The next article is from the same publication. It's a regular column entitled From My Farm by Hope Ellis Ashburn. Pumpkins and gourds. Tyler Swafford's enthusiasm for raising pumpkins and gourds is contagious. The lifelong farmer, himself the descendant of a lifelong farmer, makes his home on Dayton Mountain overlooking Tennessee's Sequatchie Valley. Swafford's father raised tomatoes and other produce and passed his passion down. Pumpkins are fun to grow, Swafford says. They are pretty to look at and can be used in decorations, and they have a lot of holistic purposes. He adds that they're very healthy for humans and livestock to eat. In his experience, chickens, cows, and pigs have a particular affinity for the popular fruit. Gourds are fun for Swafford, too. There's so many different kinds, he says. You can put them on trellises or on the ground. There are so many different things you can do. Choosing varieties. Swafford's excitement for the subject makes it easy to see why he feels that pumpkins and gourds can be a great addition to any farm. The fun starts with choosing which varieties that you will grow. Pumpkins grown for decoration have a wide variety of options to choose from. It's your preference, he says. You can get them with wrinkles, tall or oblong, short and squatty, or where they look like the traditional jack-o'-lanterns, he says. There are even choices with the stems. You can choose a variety with stems that grow as much as 20 inches long, curly, and 8 inches thick. While the long-stem jack-o'-lantern varieties are one of Swafford's favorite types to grow, he cautions that they aren't a high-yielding pumpkin variety. But whatever you want in a pumpkin now, they have it bred up and you can find it. Swafford has other favorites for pumpkins that are intended for eating. Of these varieties, Swafford enjoys raising Jarrahdales. This blue heirloom pumpkin has a good flavor in addition to having an attractive appearance. Fairy tale pumpkins are another variety that he enjoys. He describes both pumpkins as very beautiful, squatty, stackable pumpkins that create a good presentation and flavorful taste. He also enjoys the taste and appearance of the cow, New England cheddar, Long Island cheese, and New England Hubbard varieties. The different available types are almost endless, he says. When choosing a pumpkin variety to eat, Swafford advises choosing one that has a thick exterior and has a lot of meat in it, as opposed to a variety with a thinner exterior better suited for carving. For pumpkin seed lovers, Swafford recommends the kale variety. They're naturally without a hull, so you don't have to crack them to eat them. Gourd varieties primarily fall under ornamental and hard shell. Swafford's experience falls under the hard shell type. He prefers wing gourds, so named because when they grow out, they have the appearance of wings on them. They harden out well and are easy to contain. Some of the fun with wing gourds is the element of surprise they offer. When you plant them, you don't know what you will get, Swofford says. They can be all different sizes. If your preference is larger gourds, Swofford likes the gremlin variety. They are a bigger gourd that represents the wing variety, he says. The heirloom variety swan gourds are another popular variety that he recommends. Qualities he likes about them include the variation in their appearance. They harden out well, and they produce a gourd that is very favorable for making birdhouses, a characteristic that makes them an excellent choice for selling at farmers markets. If you want to get the whole family involved, snake gourds can be an outstanding choice for involving the kids. You just never know the shape they're going to make, Swofford says. And after they harden out, you can paint them. Jack B. Little and Pumpkimon pumpkins, he says, are pumpkin varieties that can be great for kids. Tips and best practices. Regardless of whether you choose to raise pumpkins, gourds, or both, after you've chosen your variety, it's time to think about how to go about raising them. Pumpkins love full sun, Swofford says, but you have to watch them. They can be a little bit moody. You can have a very beautiful fruit set, and then if they go through a little drought phase that they don't like, they can drop their fruit. If this happens, you have to start over, he says. Pumpkins also don't like herbicides. They are very sensitive to weed killers, Swofford says. As for transplanting versus direct seeding, he prefers direct seeding. Transplanting is much easier and more efficient, but we've never had much luck with it, so we direct seed, he says. There are varying options, Swofford says, as to the growing space pumpkins need. He plants his jack-o'-lantern pumpkins 4 feet apart with his rows measuring 9 feet apart. But he adds that this is for commercial scale. The main idea with planting space is that you don't want to overcrowd them. As the pumpkins grow, they naturally create a canopy that kills the weed competition. While it's important not to overcrowd, it's equally important to plant them close enough so that they can create this canopy. Without it, controlling the weed population becomes a losing venture. You can bring them in a little closer, but then you are affecting your size, he says. Once you've chosen a location with enough space, you should also consider whether it's in a low-lying area. He explains that pumpkins perform better on a slope or hillside that drains well, adding that they do not like being wet. Too much water, whether from excessive rain or from overtop watering, can cause crop loss, Swofford says. They do drink a lot of water, he says. To prevent mildew, use a drip irrigation system. They also like a lot of food, he says. While every farmer has their own opinions about fertilizer selection, Swofford starts with a base of 12-24-24. We've seen good results from it, he says. He fertilizes again after the fruit has set. If you try to fertilize when they're setting blooms, you can blow them off and they will drop their fruit, he says. He also advises being mindful of applying too much fertilizer, as this can cause the fruit to crack from growing too fast. When applying fertilizer, moderation and small amounts are key considerations to keep in mind. Swofford's planting season begins near the middle of May. The different pumpkin varieties mature at different rates. Though some have faster or slower maturity rates, on average he says that pumpkins mature between 80 and 120 days. While pumpkins can sometimes successfully be planted later, he doesn't recommend going later than June. If you're growing your pumpkins to market, such as the stackable varieties, Swofford recommends having those ready by September with your jack-o'-lantern style pumpkins ready by October. Gourds, such as pumpkins, prefer full sun, but they can be planted closer together, around 2 feet apart, with rows measuring 6 feet apart. Swofford typically plants gourds around the same time as he plants his pumpkins, seeking a mid-September to early October maturity date. Once mature, curing gourds requires an area where they can be kept cool and dry. He explains that gourds stored wet will rot. While pumpkins don't cure out, they can be stored for up to a year in a cool, dry area. Neither should be stacked. Airflow is needed for the curing process and to prevent areas of rot. A final practice that Swofford addresses is that of saving your pumpkin and gourd seeds for next year. He says that while seeds from pumpkins grown in other areas will still grow, research has shown that pumpkins store information about their environment as they grow, and they put that information into the seed for the next generation. Storing your seeds, he says, makes them better prepared for the next growing season and creates a good genetic line. He adds that the process of growing pumpkins from seeds that you have saved may take 1 to 2 years to see visible results, but he says it is well worth the effort. If you stick with it long enough, you will have a pumpkin variety that is meant to grow in your area and is better prepared to withstand the disease pressure found there. In the end, if you have ever been curious about raising pumpkins and gourds for pleasure or profit, it can be a fun adventure to plan and carry out. Hope Ellis Ashburn graduated from Middle Tennessee State University and the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, earning degrees in animal science and agriculture education. The author of three books, she enjoys using the skills she's gained as a former extension agent turned veteran educator and lifelong farmer to report on all things agriculture. She lives with her family on a century farm in the Sequatchie Valley of Southeast Tennessee. You can read more of her work at https://redhorseonaredhill.pubsitepro.com. We have just a few minutes left, so let's switch to Mother Earth News, February-March 2024, and do a little bit of Ask Our Experts. DIY seed tape. Can you recommend a do-it-yourself method for precisely sowing seeds? Seed tape is a long strip of paper with pre-spaced seeds glued inside. When planted, the paper biodegrades and the seeds sprout, creating a neat row of ideally spaced plants. Making your own seed tape is a great way to save time and seeds. You can sow more rows in less time, and the process leads to neat rows that'll require less thinning. Plus, you can prepare large quantities beforehand. In addition to seeds, you'll need scissors, measuring tape, a pencil, a paintbrush, white flour or starch, and toilet paper. Number one, in a small bowl, mix white flour or starch with water to create a paste with the consistency of school glue. You won't need much, so start by adding a tablespoon of each until you reach the right thickness. Two, next create the tape. Cut toilet paper to a width of 2 inches and as long as you like. A 3 to 4 foot long strip is a good length. Next, fold the strip of toilet paper in half lengthwise and crease it firmly. 3. Unfold the paper. Use a measuring tape and pencil to mark the distances between seeds. Place the marks in the middle of the top half of the toilet paper tape. This way, the row of seeds will be centered when you fold the strip back over itself. 4. Using a paintbrush, place a dab of homemade glue on each mark, then drop 1 or 2 seeds on each dab. Continue until you reach the end of the tape. Number 5, fold the tape back in half lengthwise and let it dry. Then roll it up and store it until use. Don't forget to label it. For optimal long-term storage, place the fully dried tape in a sealed zip close bag along with a silica gel packet and put it in the refrigerator. Planting the tape. Tear the length of seed tape you'll need for the row, lay the seed tape on the soil, and cover it with a layer of compost or soil. Water well, and when sprouts appear, thin to 1 seedling in each spot. For square foot gardens, you can use 2 disposable napkins cut to a square foot with seeds glued inside. You can also create tapes that alternate seeds of companion plants. That was written by Sam Feldman. We're out of time. You've been listening to Natural Life. I'm Kim McCurdy. As always, thanks for listening.